43. When she first woke up, she was still in her Radicea's coverall, mummified in gaffer's tape, lying on the floor of a shitty old Ford van blasting across the middle of nowhere. This did not put her in a very favorable mood. The stun bunny left her with a persistent nosebleed and an eternal throbbing headache, and every time the van hit a chuck hole, her head bounced on the corrugated steel floor. First, she was just pissed. Then she started having brief moments of fear, wanting to go home. After 8 hours in the back of the van, there was no doubt in her mind that she wanted to go home. The only thing that kept her from giving up was curiosity. As far as she could tell from this admittedly poor vantage point, this didn't look like a Fed operation. The van pulled off the highway onto a frontage road and into a parking lot. The rear doors of the van opened up and a couple of women climbed in. Through the open doors, YT could see the Gothic Arch logo of a Reverend Wayne's pearly gates.
"Oh, you poor baby,"
one of the women said. The other woman just gasped in horror at her condition. One of them just cradled her head and stroked her hair, letting her sip sweet Kool-Aid from a Dixie cup, while the other tenderly, slowly took the gaffer's tape off. Her shoes had already been removed when she woke up in the back of the van, and no one offered her another pair. And everything had been removed from her coverall. All the good stuff was gone. But they hadn't gone underneath the coverall. She still had the dog tags. And one other thing. A thing between her legs called a dentata. There's no way they could have found that. She has always known that the dog tags were probably a fake thing anyway. Uncle Enzo doesn't just go around giving his war souvenirs to 15-year-old chicks. But they still might have an effect on someone. The two women are named Marla and Bonnie. They are with her all the time. Not only with her, but touching her. Lots of hugs, squeezes, hand-holding, and tousled hair. The first time she goes to the bathroom, Bonnie goes with her, opening the stall door and actually standing in there with her. YT thinks that Bonnie is worried that she's going to pass out on the toilet or something. But the next time she has to pee, Marla goes with her. She gets no privacy at all. The only problem is, she can't deny that she likes it in a way. The ride in the van hurt. It really hurt bad. She never felt so lonely in her life. And now she's barefoot and defenseless in an unfamiliar place, and they're giving her what she needs. After she had a few minutes to freshen up, whatever that means, inside the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates, she and Marla and Bonnie climbed into a big stretch van with no windows. The floor was carpeted, but there were no seats inside. Everyone sat on the floor. The van was jammed when they opened the rear doors. 20 people were packed into it, all energetic, beaming youths. It looked impossible. YT shrank away from it, backing right into Marla and Bonnie. But a cheerful roar came up from the van people, white teeth flashing in the dimness, and people began to scrunch out a tiny space for them. She spent most of the next 2 days packed into the van between Bonnie and Marla, holding hands with them constantly, so she couldn't even pick her nose without permission. They sang happy songs until her brain turned to tapioca. They played wacky games. A couple of times every hour, someone in the van would start to babble, just like the Falabellas, just like the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates people. The babbling would spread throughout the van like a contagious disease, and soon everyone would be doing it. Everyone except for YT. She couldn't seem to get the hang of it. It just seemed embarrassingly stupid to her, so she just faked it. 3 times a day they had a chance to eat and eliminate. It always happened in burbclaves. YT could feel them pulling off the interstate, finding their way down twisty development lanes, courts, ways, and circles. A garage door would rise electrically. The van would pull in, the door would shut behind them. They would go into a suburban house, except stripped of furniture and other family touches, and sit on the floor in empty bedrooms, one for boys, one for girls, and eat cake and cookies. This always happened in a totally empty room in a house, but there was always different decor. In one place, flowery, countryish wallpaper and a lingering smell of rancid glade. In another, bluish wallpaper featuring hockey players, football players, basketball players. In another, just plain white walls with old crayon marks on them. Sitting in these empty rooms, YT would study the old furniture scrapes on the floors, the dents in the sheetrock, and muse over them like an archaeologist, wondering about the long-departed families who had once lived here. But toward the end of the ride, she wasn't paying attention anymore. In the van, she could hear nothing but singing and chanting, see nothing but the jammed-together faces of her companions. When they stopped for gas, they did it in giant truck stops out in the middle of nowhere, pulling up to the most distant pump island so that no one was near them. And they never stopped driving. They just got relayed from one driver to the next. Finally, they got to a coast. YT could smell it. They spent a few minutes waiting, engine idling, and then the van bumped over some kind of a threshold, climbed a few ramps, stopped, set its parking brake. The driver got out and left them all alone in the van for the first time. YT felt glad that the trip was over. Then everything started to rumble, like an engine noise, but a lot bigger. She didn't feel any movement until a few minutes later when she realized that everything was rocking gently. The van was parked on a ship, and the ship was headed out to sea. It's a real ocean-going ship. An old, shitty, rusty one that probably cost about $5 at the ship junkyard. But it carries cars, and it goes through the water, and it doesn't sink. The ship is just like the van, except bigger, with more people. But they eat the same stuff, sing the same songs, and sleep just as rarely as ever. By now, YT finds it perversely comforting. She knows that she's with a lot of other people like her, and that she's safe. She knows the routine. She knows where she belongs. And so finally they come to the raft. No one has told YT this is where they're going, but by now it's obvious. She ought to be scared. But they wouldn't be going to the raft if it was as bad as everyone says. When it starts coming into view, she half expects them to converge on her with gaffer's tape again. But then she figures out it's not necessary. She hasn't been causing trouble. She's been accepted here. They trust her. It gives her a feeling of pride, in a way. And she won't cause trouble on the raft because all she can do is escape from their part of it onto the raft per se. As such, the real raft, the raft of 100 Hong Kong B-movies and blood-soaked Nipponese comic books. It doesn't take much imagination to think of what happens to lone 15-year-old blonde American girls on the raft, and these people know it. Sometimes she worries about her mother. Then she hardens her heart and thinks maybe the whole thing will be good for her. Shake her up a little, which is what she needs. After Dad left, she just folded up into herself like an origami bird thrown into a fire. There is kind of an outer cloud of small boats surrounding the raft for a distance of a few miles. Almost all of them are fishing boats. Some of them carry men with guns, but they don't fuck around with this ferry. The ferry swings through this outer zone, making a broad turn, finally zeroing in on a white neighborhood on one flank of the raft. Literally white. All the boats here are clean and new. There's a couple of big rusty boats with Russian lettering on the side, and the ferry pulls up alongside one of them. Ropes are thrown across, then augmented with nets, gangplanks, webs of old discarded tires. This raft thing does not look like good skating territory at all. She wonders if any of the other people on board this ferry are skaters. Doesn't seem likely. Really, they are not her kind of people at all. She has always been a dirty scumdog of the highways, not one of these happy sing-along types. Maybe the raft is just the place for her. They take her down into one of the Russian ships and give her the grossest job of all time, cutting up fish. She does not want a job, has not asked for one. but that's what she gets. Still, no one really talks to her. No one bothers to explain anything, and that makes her reluctant to ask. She has just run into a massive cultural shockwave, because most of the people on this ship are old and fat and Russian and don't speak English. For a couple of days, she spends a lot of time sleeping on the job, being prodded awake by the hefty Russian dames who work in this place. She also does some eating. Some of the fish that comes through this place looks pretty rank, but there's a fair amount of salmon. The only way she knows this is from having sushi at the mall. Salmon is the orange-red stuff. So she makes some sushi of her own, munches down on some fresh salmon meat, and it's good. It clears her head a little. Once she gets over the shock of it and settles into a routine, she starts looking around her, watching the other fish-cutting dames, and realizes that this is just like life must be for about 99% of the people in the world. You're in this place. There's other people all around you, but they don't understand you, and you don't understand them, but people do a lot of pointless babbling anyway. In order to stay alive, you have to spend all day, every day, doing stupid, meaningless work. And the only way to get out of it is to quit, cut loose, take a flyer, and go off into the wicked world where you will be swallowed up and never heard from again. She's not especially good at cutting up fish. The big, stout Russian chicks, stomping, slab-faced babushkas, keep giving her a hassle. They keep hovering, watching her cut with this look on their face like they can't believe what a dork she is. Then they try to show her how to do it the right way, but she's still not so good at it. It's hard, and her hands are cold and stiff all the time. After a couple of frustrating days, they give her a new job, farther down the production line. They turn her into a cafeteria dame, like one of the slop slingers in the high school lunchroom. She works in the galley of one of the big Russian ships, hauling vats of cooked fish stew out to the buffet line, ladling it out into bowls, shoving it across the counter at an unending line consisting of religious fanatics, and more religious fanatics. Except this time around, there seems to be a lot more Asians and hardly any Americans at all. They have a new species here, too. People with antennas coming out of their heads. The antennas look like the ones on cop walkie-talkies, short, blunt, black rubber whips. They rise up from behind the ear. The first time she sees one of these people, she figures it must be some kind of new Walkman, and she wants to ask the guy where he got it, what he's listening to. But he's a strange guy, stranger than all of the others, with a permanent thousand-yard stare and a bad case of the mumbles, and he ends up giving her the creep so bad that she just shoves an extra-large dose of stew in his face and hurries him on down the line. From time to time, she actually recognizes one of the people who are in the van. But they don't seem to recognize her. They just look right through her, glassy-eyed, like they've been brainwashed, like YT was brainwashed. She can't believe it has taken her this long to figure out what they were doing to her. And that just makes her more pissed.